Would you be shocked to learn that American institutions and citizens have been the subject of directed and purposeful manipulation? Would you be surprised to learn that American media is nothing more than the mouthpiece of a handful of corporations that carefully craft what people think is news? Would you be dismayed to hear that our cherished freedom, in the context that the Founding Fathers envisioned it, is a mirage? Do you know that if you live in America, you are a subject of the most widespread data collection and surveillance efforts ever known to man? My interview with culture researcher and commentator John Adams is next, here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes. Search for Soaring Eagle Radio. Find us on Facebook, Soaring Eagle Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. You can visit our website as well, www.soaringeagleradio.com. America's been referred to as the great experiment, as America the beautiful, as America land of the free, and even as America a shining example of liberty. How does all of this line up with what we are witnessing today in America? Do these descriptions still apply, if they ever really did? How are we to understand the present turmoil seemingly on every front in America? Friends, have you ever considered that culture is created? The way we think, feel, and behave has been meticulously planned and through a variety of stimuli, events, and even tragedies, an envisioned culture has been brought to fruition. Here to discuss this idea of culture creation is John Adams. John is a host on the popular Drive Time podcast Afternoon Commute Hoax Busters and is a culture researcher and commentator. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, John.
Thank you. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing very well, John, and I very much appreciate you joining me for this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. Your research is very, very interesting to me. Some of the things that you've learned and found out, and I've listened to many of your shows, are very informative. But what I've laid out here today, some will consider to be bold or even outlandish claims concerning the reality of life in America. I imagine that some people, in fact, will dismiss you and me and this whole conversation as nonsense, but I'd like to remind our listeners of one of my favorite rejoinders, and that is this, quote, "Your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko," end quote. It's really my way of saying, check the data, the facts are staring you in the face. John, culture is not an amorphous, unguided process of chance and time. Culture is instead a deliberately and consciously shaped context. Understanding culture in this way assists us in seeing that a series of many steps have been applied to produce the current status of organizations, institutions, fads, trends, and even the individuals that constitute and contribute to them. When we're talking about culture, John, let's start with a definition of culture creation. What do you mean by that when you use that phrase?
Culture creation, first you'd have to start out like with that you're born into your culture. It's already there when you come out of the womb, and then as you grow up in it, you're not really taught to question where things come from. And your parents weren't taught to question where things come from, and their parents were. And so if you were to take something as simple as television, everybody, you know, since the 1950s, grew up with television. And as they grew up with television already in the culture, it became a normality.
Yes.
And television isn't anything but a normality.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not natural.
Yes.
And so there are, I'd say, 96% of everybody's culture today is completely and totally manufactured. Everything from your emotions, your feelings, your ideas, are implanted into you without you knowing it, because you grew up with the culture all around you. It's like you're born into a fog.
Mm.
And all of the things that run parallel through culture also run parallel through media. And since we primarily, I think most people would associate culture with media today,
mm-hmm.
or that's where they get their culture from.
Yes.
You might think of somebody as like, oh, I'm part of high culture. I get my culture from the arts or something. Well, even the arts has scenes and memes running through the artwork, or you know, the ballet or whatever it is you may want to call it. And but most people get their idea of culture from movies, television, music, etc. And all of the themes that are running through all of those things are simultaneously just happen to be running through the culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we take for granted that those things are happening organically or by, you know, just magically, I guess. All seem to simultaneously coincide, and that's not the case. There are many books written on this particular subject, and once you've perused a few of those, you'll find out that culture is designed and
yes.
planned out. And just to give you a quick example, is if you were to go to the country of Brazil. Just one example. Brazil has a ministry of culture. And so if your culture was something that was happening organically, why would the government need a ministry of culture?
That's right.
That's just an interesting question you might want to ask yourself.
Yeah. They perhaps try to pose it as or justify having that ministry of culture as a means to preserve and protect what exists, and actually it's the other way around, isn't it? They're trying to create.
Yeah, and you know, that's not to say that organic things can't arise inside of a culture, because they
right.
do.
Yes.
But what you're going to find is, especially in America, is what you would call monoculture or homogenization,
mm-hmm.
and that happens through mass media. And that's why you see so many of the same. You could drive cross country, and you could find all the same stores in California that you could find in Ohio.
Yes.
Because it's a corporate culture. It's a consumer culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only based around making money, though. There's something much larger to it. It's basically people who are involved in a culture where consuming disposable, I guess you'd call it disposable culture also.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where your entire life is revolved around consuming things. You don't really take notice too much as to where those things are coming from. So you don't mind the fact that the corner store, you know, with the mom and pop shop doesn't exist anymore, because as long as you're able to get the goods that you want, and not even things that you need, just the things that you desire that you've been sold.
Mm-hmm.
through the consumer culture, as long as you're able to get those things, you don't really care where they come from. So that's why you see the monoculture, the mega corporation culture everywhere.
Yes. Yeah. And isn't it, it's a good example, I think, speaking about culture this way and it being created, and it's a top-down kind of thing. Now, you did make the point that there are some instances where things in our culture are organic, but for the most part, it's a top-down thing. And a phrase that came to mind as you were describing that, John, was life imitating art. We're shown a preferred view of life, a preferred philosophy or opinion or viewpoint on any particular subject. And what happens through the medium of TV and other medium is that folks begin to adopt that viewpoint. Isn't that the case?
Yes. There was a group of guys. They were called the Frankfurt School. You're not familiar with them. They were
yes.
philosophers, sociologists,
mm-hmm.
Marxists.
Yes.
Well, and they were employed by the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA.
Yes.
At some point, they came over from Frankfurt, Germany. And what their job was primarily was to disrupt culture through implementing things through the academia, because most people aren't aware of the fact that there's people out there who work for a particular institution to implement things into culture.
Yes.
And so that's kind of what they're bred for in a certain sense when they come up through academia, and it has to do with the study of sociology and you know, the way humans relate to each other and all sorts of things. But it's also to control people.
Yes.
There's a control factor involved. And so when the Frankfurt School came over here and lived in Hollywood, of all places, because that would be the main hub of media control at, you know, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s,
mm-hmm. yes.
and still today, you could go read the book, or I'm sorry, the essay by Theodore Adorno, who was one of the main philosophers. And Adorno was a genius. Don't get me wrong. He was a very smart fellow. But he doesn't really appear to be, at least the way that I see it, appear to be doing something altruistic with that knowledge. And so one of the essays that he wrote was called The Culture Industry. Now, he is correct that there is a culture industry. Anytime industry is attached to anything, it's mostly, you know, about making money.
Yes.
So you have, and so he talked about the culture industry, and one of the things he talked about in the essay is that by that time, I think he's writing in the 1940s, he had already come to the conclusion that the purpose of movies was to give people a blueprint for how their lives were going to be lived.
Hmm.
And he even projected, and I'm sure he had insight into this, that soon you wouldn't even be able to tell the difference between reality and the movies, and that they would kind of blend seamlessly, you know, into one another. And we actually are starting to see that today. And one of the ways that you actually are able to achieve that is what you call vicarious living.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And people live vicariously through the cult of celebrity and through their possessions. Their possessions and I guess you would, to borrow from Rodgers and Hammerstein, their favorite things
mm-hmm.
Become part of their identity.
Mm. Yes, that's right.
And you know, you lose yourself in the things that you possess, and in the process, you become controlled by the people who design those possessions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. An interesting thought came to mind. You were talking about Adorno and his understanding. Really, he was a prophet in a sense, prophesying, giving a prophecy of just how powerful the medium of movie making was to become. And I find it interesting. I was thinking while you were talking, John, that how interesting that the previews of coming attractions would be little snippets of movies yet to be released, whose the sole purpose of that little snippet was to heighten people's interest, to pique their curiosity, and to make them want to see the movie. That seems to be a real brief synopsis of what you've just said about Adorno and the Frankfurt School. Now, Adorno, was he? Would you define or describe him as a Fabian socialist?
Not technically. Fabian socialism is a little bit different in the technical sense. Well, the same ball of wax, pretty much. I think what they were doing is him and the guys that he was associated with. They put on airs like they were just Marxists, but yet they had no problem coming and living in Hollywood. So it's already a contradiction in terms of
right
there.
Yeah.
Also, they worked for Western intelligence agencies. And you have to ask the question, why would a Western intelligence agency hire Marxist philosophers from a German school? Like I said, it's all the same ball of wax.
Yes.
And so when you read the writings of these guys, you get the sense of that they might be, you know, have your best interest in mind.
Right. Yeah.
While they're doing this, because that's the approach that they're taking and the phraseology that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
But their goal is primarily to disrupt the current culture.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that culture is good or not is not the argument. It's right. Just the fact that it's going to be disrupted
right
and done away with. And so, you know, in the present day, we have current things happening, overthrowing old norms and bringing in what you would call the new normal.
Yes.
That's an actual phrase that they use, new normals.
Mm-hmm.
And the old normals that you believed in will be replaced with new normals. And they really do count on the fact that people are not going to recognize this.
Right.
Or if they do recognize it, they'll soon get mad, but they'll soon adapt to it, and they'll either, one, they'll stay silent about it, not really speak up too much about it because everybody else is adapting to it quite well, or they're just going to adapt to it and say, well, that's okay, no big deal, because everything's fine, nothing really totally disrupted my life, I still have my TV, I'm still able to drive my car and go to work every day, so no big deal.
Yeah.
And so you know, you had brought up to me B.F. Skinner.
Yes.
And B.F. Skinner was another one of these types, I guess you would call him. He was a very strange fellow, and he's responsible for the term behavioral psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And he studied human beings in a particular way that you know would be similar to Ivan Pavlov, which is why you have Bell School.
Mm.
Okay? Literally, that's why you have a Bell in school. Everybody takes for granted the fact that you have a Bell in school, not because it's telling you when it's time for recess, but it's conditioning you to be a human dog, basically.
Mm-hmm. To respond.
And so, yeah, to respond to the Bell.
So
means it's time to get up. Out of the classroom, or it's time to go into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things were not designed with your best interest in mind, no matter how much you would like to believe that.
Right.
And Skinner played a big part in a lot of this as well. And he had a very interesting phrase, very interesting on multiple levels, but just on the level that he presented it, he called it shaping behavior. And he is the alleged originator of that idea of shaping behavior, what you would call operant behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of similar to Pavlovian style conditioning.
Yes.
But it's a little bit different because what he found out is you could do what was called a chain studying, where in the Pavlovian studies, or in the Pavlov studies, he had the dog, you know, salivates when you ring the bell and mm-hmm. get the food.
Yes.
Right? And that's the simplistic version of it.
Right.
They don't ever talk about all of the children that he actually experimented on.
There's a reason for that, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's very suppressed history right
mm-hmm.
there. But B.F. Skinner took it even one step further. He did weird things, like he raised his daughter until she was 2 years old inside of a box.
I hadn't read that. Wow.
Yeah, it's called the Skinner box.
People are locked up for things today like that.
Yeah, he had some pretty bizarre ideas, and once again, you could actually read his books, and maybe you might even agree with some of the stuff that he's talking about. You might even think, man, this guy's not too bad of a guy. He sounds like a nice guy. But then he starts getting into eugenics and how people's genetics play a part. And his basic overall theory was that we have no actual free will. Because we have no free will, we are strictly creatures of our environment and our genetic makeup.
Okay.
And so, based off of Darwinian evolution, and the randomness of Darwinian evolution, which is absolute nonsense.
Right.
our genetics and our environment predict exactly how we will respond to certain situations. So based off of this, he came up with what was called behavioral psychology, and where you could, if you could design a culture, then you could actually control the people inside of that culture. And like I said, to a large extent, he is correct, because we're seeing that now. We've been seeing it for a very long time. And I don't believe that this idea originated with B.F. Skinner. He was kind of a pitch man. Every generation has a pitch man for the same old method of control. And he just happened to be the pitch man for his particular generation because, you know, he was plastered all over Time Magazine and Newsweek during his day as being, you know, this genius who thought this up. But, I mean, even in his books, which I've only read two of them, and in the 20 others that he's written, he even talks about Plato's Republic and More's Utopia as being kind of a model for his idea. So like I said, he is correct that you can control people through designing a culture, and you can control their behavior, but he fudged a lot of his things within his theories, because there is an element, there still is that element to humans that is unpredictable.
Right.
And he couldn't come up with a proper explanation as to why that was. He said he had all of these extra theories based off of why humans didn't respond to certain things. So he was not correct. And I think that's one of the main problems that people who want to control other people have, is don't actually really know how people are going to respond wholeheartedly.
Right. Yeah, and I would suggest to the disciples of Skinner today, because there are many psychologists who practice based on a behavioral framework, and I would suggest to them the reason they can't answer that question, John, is because they've got the wrong worldview. Mankind is much more than what sociologists and psychologists claim or believe that we are. So Skinner was saying that basically designing a culture is like designing an experiment.
Yeah, that's a quote from his book,
yep.
Beyond Freedom and Dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the actual quote is, a culture is very much like the experimental space used in the analysis of behavior. Both sets of contingencies of reinforcement. A child is born into a culture as an organism is placed in an experimental space. Designing the culture is like designing an experiment.
Yes. Yeah. So taking that then, the melding of sociology, psychology, and some other streams of thought, one example of creating culture is the fashion, and I guess we could even say the technology industries. How do trends and fashions and the latest have-to-have items, how are those culturally created, John?
Well, what happens is people primarily in the what you call the fashion industry, the music industry, and like you said, the technology industry, on the lowest level, they're motivated by money. Okay?
Yeah.
And survival. That is true.
Yeah.
But there is an element to that is a look, you know, maybe a level of a strata of those people who are motivated by power.
Mm, yeah.
And control. And so we've been bred, for lack of a better word, in, for over a long period of time to be, like I was talking about before, disposable consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, you associate consuming and convenience with necessity.
Right.
So if you see a $300 pair of tennis shoes, and everybody that you know is wearing those tennis shoes, you need those
right. Shoes.
You don't desire. It's a desire.
Yeah.
This has to do with a lot with experimentation in psychiatry with Freud initially, and Freud being pushed onto the American public as well, and his nephew, who took all of the research that was done by Freud, which I believe this was the purpose behind Freud, was to find out what people actually desired. And then his nephew was Edward Bernays, who is lauded as the basically the guy who created public relations and
yes. The
modern day advertising model.
Yeah.
Well, he just happened to come from the same family as the guy who did all the experiments and finding out what people actually desired. Coincidence, of course.
Right, just a coincidence.
Yeah. So yeah, they had all this research on what people desired, and what Freud found out, allegedly, was that most people just desire to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they wanted. They most people out there, they are not power hungry, they're not power mad, they're not interested in what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're just interested in being entertained and being happy.
Being happy.
And I think we are actually designed that way.
Well, let me ask you something, John, because a thought comes to mind here. I've noticed in the past several years that many commercials on television, they no longer tout their product necessarily. Take an automobile, for example. You're not going to hear about the size of the engine unless it's a pickup truck. Then that commercial might say it's someplace in there. But I've noticed that for car commercials and other things, it's all about creating this image that you will be happy if you have our product. It doesn't talk about performance, doesn't talk about specifications. It just paints this rosy picture that if you want to be satisfied with your life, then you should buy our product. And I think that's part of that is what you're talking about here. Bernays found, and his uncle Sigmund no doubt helped him understand human triggers for emotion and happiness. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an old thing that you're referring to there. It may be more prominently brought out to where, like you said, that the actual necessary information for a product is kind of subdued.
Yes.
And the more, but yeah, I mean, they started doing that in the 1950s, where they would talk about, you know, the I guess you would call the cooler aspects of a particular vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Like say, this vehicle is better because it's got bigger tailpin.
Yeah.
you know, or something like that. How would you, you know, this is a show, you know, a beautiful girl and a nice looking man, and they're driving down the highway, and it says, "This is how you will look in our new car."
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Of course, when I think about how I look, I won't look anything like that man, and I won't have that beautiful woman sitting next to me. And so people, to get back to the idea of fashion, friends, and fads, and things of that nature, it has to do with momentary bliss.
Mm.
Because notice how fast fads and trends come and go.
Yes.
And they actually used to take quite a bit longer, but not that much. You know, there's a good book, if anybody's interested. It's called Only Yesterday. It was written by a guy named Frederick Lewis Allen. He was writing it in the 1930s, and he wrote it about the 1920s. And he wrote about all of the fads and trends that had come and gone just from the switch from the 20s to the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is full of fads and trends that had come and gone. So we've been like this for a long time. But it's accelerating. And the interesting thing about acceleration, another book people might be interested in is the 1971 bestseller Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, who was promoted in that particular era as a techno prophet. Of course, I don't think he was prophet in the sense of prophet. He was more profit. Because that's what he was doing, was profiting. But,
yes.
But yeah, these guys, they're not prophets, they're not predicting anything, it's all mapped out ahead of time.
Yes.
But one thing he talks about is acceleration in society, and what acceleration does to people psychologically.
Mm.
And what it does is it shortens situations. Like, you have your everyday, day-to-day situation, but if things appear to be speeding up, like, say, in the media, how fast does an article or something stay in the news cycle?
Right.
News cycles turn over really quickly nowadays, and even back in the 70s, they turned over pretty quickly from just the time period before. This changes your behavior. It speeds you up psychologically to where now you're dealing with things at a faster pace.
Mm-hmm.
More information. We talk about weaponized information, where what you would call an info bomb hits you with so much information all at once, you're not able to absorb it all.
That's right.
But yet, it's been absorbed by the subconscious, and it's passed through the news cycle, or it's passed through time, and so you kind of look at it, you don't absorb the information, but you know that it's past. You know that it's old now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an impression that they intentionally created.
Yes, and you were talking about images. Well, images have been used for quite a long time to convey messages.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of information in an image that your brain doesn't pick up consciously, but it picks up subconsciously. And so when teenage girls are seeing, Kim Kardashian on television, and they're watching these television shows, you know, I mean, this has been around for a long time. Scantily clad women have been on television for a very long time.
Right.
There is an impression made on them just by the image. Okay?
Yes.
And it's affecting you, and it's affecting you either one way or the other. Well, you're either, maybe you don't like that particular image, or maybe you do, and you decide you want to model yourself after that particular image. Well, see, the culture creators have mapped out how people are going to respond one way or the other. They know ahead of time that there are certain people who are going to resist certain things, and they're not going to like it at first. Okay?
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of, as you said, triggers for certain things, if they want to trigger a response that could, they might even want a negative response to something. This can be done through imagery, okay?
Yes.
And imagery, like I said, it's very powerful. You just have to see a picture in a newspaper or a magazine, the image of something on television. You don't even need a caption.
That's right.
Telling you what's going on, and you can come to a particular conclusion based off of just what you see with the image.
Yeah. And for our listeners, John, let me interject this. By way of explanation, John said sometimes triggers are used to elicit negative reactions or negative responses. Let me break that down just a little bit. I think what John is talking about there is purposeful manipulation, which all of this is. But in this particular context, I think that's done for a negative response or reaction intentionally, so that then that group of people who are resisting can be vilified. And that goes on a lot in our media today.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, the negative, they definitely look for a negative response, because you have to understand something, too, is that in order to move an agenda forward, you need opposition.
Yes.
Okay?
Yep.
Opposition is imperative to moving an agenda forward, because without the opposition to something, the opposition provides reinforcement to the people who are in favor of something.
Mm-hmm.
So it is just how you said, the opposition reinforces the people's belief in whatever it is that they're doing. So if, you know, take any topic of the current, you know, ridiculousness all over television and news, apply what you would call, you know, the dialectic process of synthesis,
thesis antithesis results in a synthesis.
That's correct. That is correct. I had a little senior moment there in my, near, and I'm only near 40. Well, you know what? Let me read you something out of a book that is a very rare book, and see if this is something you might find interesting here.
Okay.
This book is, like I said, it's a rare book. It's called Cultural Patterns and Technical Change, and it was put out by the United Nations Education, UNESCO.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
That's frightening already, just knowing who the publishers are.
Yeah, and it was edited by good old Margaret Mead.
Oh, boy. Wow.
So let me read you this, and this should be very interesting to someone who might not really take to what we're saying right now, okay?
Okay.
It seems painfully evident that most miserable living conditions from the viewpoint of industrial nations do not of themselves make technical improvements acceptable, nor make disruption and maladjustment less likely once change is introduced. Over and over again, we see that attempts to remedy such conditions chiefly by knowledge and logic, as seen by the agents of change, fail. Those failures can be better understood if it is recognized that explanation and logical interpretation alone are often ineffective in changing behavior, because their application is blocked by the emotional satisfaction which the individual achieves through his present mode of life. The new knowledge can be put to use only as the old behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes are unlearned and the appropriate new behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes are learned.
Yeah. There it is in a nutshell.
It goes on and on,
but I
won't read any more from that. But yeah, it goes on and on, and it's a doozy, let me tell you that.
Yeah, that's pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah, and that this basically is a handbook for change agents, for people who are providing cultural change to said culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You see?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, John, let's apply all this for our listeners. I know that there will be some who say, oh, you know, this sounds great, all this theoretical and psychological and philosophical, but what does it really all mean? So let's apply this to some of the things that we're seeing in America today, to what I would consider to be some very weighty matters and issues. And let's start by talking about the family. Clearly, the family has undergone a tremendous upheaval, to the extent that what was once lauded as the very foundation, strength, and fabric of society has been systematically destroyed by cultural designers. How in the world has this happened? How have we got to the place where a two-parent, mother, father, and children household is looked at with scorn? Where did the unraveling begin?
It's hard to say exactly where it began. I guess you could say in the modern times, after World War One is a good place to start. 1920s really was very disruptive time period. As much as I enjoy old-time music like jazz and things of that nature, you know, old rock and roll,
yeah,
it was culturally created and designed to disrupt the previous type of person who existed in another time period. And so if you think of the 1920s, just an example that I myself never even thought about until it was pointed out to me by another researcher, was that, you know, women in the 1900s wore skirts down to their ankles, and in no time at all, once the World War One was over, women were wearing skirts above their knees.
Mm-hmm.
You have a division, a purposeful division between adults and children that has been taking place since the late 1940s. A phrase came into the culture in the late 1940s called young person.
Yes.
Okay. Before, there used to be only adults and children.
Okay? Yes.
That was it.
That was subtly slipped in, wasn't it?
Yes. Then there was young person. And so young person morphed into a word that was literally created, I'm not kidding, it was created by the Madison Avenue advertising agencies called the teenager. Okay, we take that word for granted these days, but teenager was specifically designed for someone between the ages of 13 and 19, and it was then from then on classified as an age group. Now today we have what are called tweens.
Right.
And post-teen. Okay, so you have the arrested development male, the rest of development female, mm-hmm, who lives with their parents till they're 30 years old, and those type of things. And so what you could look at it as the breakdown of the family, where a lot of these people have had less and less children as time went on. Back in the late 1800s, the 1900s, even into the 1920s, people had large families.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then by the time the 1950s came around, people were only having three children. Well, that was a cultural design because they told you that the nuclear family was the thing to be. You moved away from your extended family, you moved out somewhere when the extended family used to be primarily included in the family.
Yes.
And,
John, for our listeners, let me just say this, to take into consideration what John is saying and the impact that that has had on us today. Consider this thought. If someone has four children or more, or even consider six or seven children today, one of the first things that they're going to be asked is, are you Roman Catholic? Or maybe if you live out west, are you Mormon? Because people with lots of children, well, they must be religious because nobody does that, right? So that's an assumption that people are making today, to your point, John.
That's correct. And I am one of five children, and I used to frequently just get asked if I was Mormon or Catholic when I was growing up.
Yes.
And so, that's what... Whereas... there was a time period when five children wasn't enough.
That's correct. That's right. So, well, they had farms, and they needed, a lot of work.
And Yeah, that's right. And another thing, too, was by the time the 1950s rolled around, culture and life in and of itself had dramatically changed and dramatically shifted. That's when the consumer-based society really kicked off. We had what was referred to as a military-industrial complex really had arisen out of World War II.
Yes.
It was primarily always in place, but it really came to the forefront where we had what was called a war-based economy.
Yes.
And so people were constantly making things for the production of war.
Mm-hmm.
Also, on top of that, the consumer goods society arose out of that as well, where people not only produced things that they themselves bought, but like I said before, their identity became wrapped up in the things they produced and purchased.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it didn't seem foreign to them, and now still to this day, because we don't even produce the things we purchase anymore.
Right. That's right.
People's identities are tied up with that. So it's the same thing with the nuclear family, which was pushed on an entire generation of people. Only have you separate from your extended family. You only have three children,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And they gave you the image of the immigrant, right, who was going to be demonized.
Mm-hmm.
And only immigrants had more than three children.
Right, yes.
And what they did was they scared everybody out of having more than three children by saying, oh, look at the poor downtrodden immigrant. The reason they can't make their way up in society is because they have so many children.
Mm. Psychological manipulation.
And they economically cannot survive.
Mm-hmm.
And see, one of the goals that you'll find out by reading a lot of these people, like B.F. Skinner, and like many other people of that ilk, is that there's too many people on the planet, and we need to get rid of a lot of them.
That's
and
right.
We need to make sure that people stop having children. Well, what do you have today? You have people who not only do they not have children, but they don't even get married.
Right. Yeah.
And it's an epidemic, and I will mm-hmm. say, unfortunately, it even crosses over into the religious realm as well, because even Christians and Catholics and
yes.
people who believe in... It would be unheard of to be a Christian in previous time periods and not have children. I know that for a fact.
Right, right. You're absolutely right, though, John. I've seen that increasingly in the church where a man and a woman who profess faith in Christ have no issue with not just not having children, but not even getting married. Living together, they've completely abandoned the idea of the sanctity of marriage and the covenant relationship. So, all of that has certainly. Go ahead, John.
Well, quickly, don't misunderstand me. I believe in the institution of marriage between a man and a woman, but I do not believe in the current idea of what marriage is, where you ask the state permission.
Right.
You get married, and then you go get a license. You got to remember, mm-hmm. a license is something, you get a license to do something that outside of having that license would mm-hmm. be illegal.
Yes.
Right?
That's
kind of
right.
Like a driver's license. Why mm-hmm. would I need a license to marry my wife? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Unless you know that the state wants to have their hand in everything that you do.
Yes.
So yes, I am against the idea of what you would call institutional marriage, but not mm-hmm. necessarily against the idea of the institution of marriage.
Yes, correct. Yeah. I think some of that's coming to a head now, too, with, as you said, the marriage license was sold originally as a way to make sure that your spouse was covered in the case of death for insurance purposes. For title property deeds, all of these kinds of benefits. That's why it was a good thing to do. It was never presented as because we will decide who will be married or not. It was never given in that context. But I think in the current climate that we live in, I can see a day when that's coming. And there is a movement afoot among some of the pastors that I talk to where we are going to perform marriage ceremonies, but we're not going to do it under the authority of the state, and we're not going to sign off on licenses and that type of thing. So we're going to get completely away from that.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
So the family, we were talking about the changes that the family has undergone. So how did we get to this place then where we've gone from a mother and a father to now we've got, it's perfectly normal and natural and celebrated to have two fathers and two mothers in the picture?
Well, like I said, there's all sorts of new normals that are introduced all over the place, and it doesn't even have anything to do with the people necessarily, who you might disagree with their particular lifestyle.
Right.
Their lifestyle primarily has been sold to them through their culture as well.
Yes.
And like I said, you could refer to the book by Alvin Toffler, Future Shock, where he actually talks about lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And how lifestyles are going to be a fad. And people will have these interchangeable lifestyles where they'll try them on like, you know, a new pair of pants every day. And so we see a lot of that currently. And there is a push to, you know, to change the normality of what we tend to think of as normal.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I don't really get into the whole idea of, you know, judging people based off of their lifestyle choices. None of my business, and I personally don't even really care what someone else is doing. But I know what normal is. And I know that it's not normal to live with, or to, you know, engage in a lifestyle with someone of the same sex. It's not normal.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's good or bad is, I'm just being objective on that particular issue.
Yeah.
Whether, if I remain objective on it, I can just see, well, it's not normal. So no matter how much you tell me that this is a new normal, it's still not normal.
Right, right. Yeah,
based
you can,
off of
yeah.
That alone, I know that societies don't really function too well when there aren't normalities.
Right.
And whereas I think to a certain extent, there's always room for abnormalities, but when a society gets enveloped by complete and total abnormality, it turns into a hedonistic society.
Yeah.
And the best type of society to rule over is a hedonistic society, because you have people who are constantly distracted by things that are of no matter.
That's right. Yeah. And just to elaborate, just to elaborate a little bit on your point, John, what you were saying there is that you can oppose a...
What's that?
I was just saying, I was going to elaborate a little bit on the point that you were making. Is that you can objectively look at a lifestyle and determine that it's detrimental to good health, it's detrimental to the furtherance of a family or society. And you can do that based on all kinds of factors, and one of them which is not any kind of religious belief system. You don't need a religious belief system to look at a lifestyle and say, this has all kinds of negative consequences as a result of it, and it would be unwise to pursue it. And yet, in our culture today, alternative lifestyles, or the new normal, as you've described it, John, that is billed, defined, celebrated as progress, as being very progressive, and that's become a good thing in the eyes of many people. How in the world do abnormalities or things that have detrimental impacts on people as individuals and families as a unit, how can that be defined as progress?
The I'm going to redirect your question.
Okay.
And I do this slightly facetiously. What is progress, Mike?
Exactly. That's a very good...
When somebody tells you that something is progressive, do they have the definition to back it up that it actually is progress?
That's right. Well, so let me answer your question as I think the culture would.
What are we progressing toward?
That's right. There's this kind of ambiguous, ubiquitous idea of enlightenment, and progress is striving to become more enlightened. Now that opens up a whole other box, though, doesn't it? Because what does it mean to be enlightened? The real point here, John, I think that you're driving at, is that we're being given the definition of these things. We're not coming up with these on our own. They're not empirically verifiable because we've lived it and experienced it, and yes, I know this is true, this is progress. No, we're being given these definitions. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I don't even know that we're actually being given the definition. It's just kind of force-fed to us and with no definition, and you're going to accept it, or you're going to be quote-unquote old-fashioned.
Ah.
And so, there is no defining progress today. Mm-hmm. There never was, really.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the idea? What was the idea behind? You could look at all of the so-called progress that we've made over centuries. And if all of that was leading up to man merging with machine or becoming some sort of bisexual hermaphrodite in the end,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
What good was building all of those railroads?
Yeah.
because that's the progress we're sold. Mm-hmm. We're sold that the progress of conquering the West and building the railroads is exactly the same progress as today, as merging technology with man and becoming this intersexual being that, or transgender, transracial, trans mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah,
and this is all built off of once again, people love utopias.
Yes.
They love living for something that will never exist. It's just never going to exist. They live for a dream. They have an image that's been implanted in them of something that is to come, and it never actually materializes.
Yeah.
And it actually ends up being detrimental. And like I was saying before, the easiest people to rule, if you want to be a tyrant,
mm-hmm.
are the people who are distracted,
mm-hmm.
dumbed down, and whose most important things in life to them are living vicariously through somebody else, like celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more involved about I want to know who's having sex with who than even knowing what's going on in their daily life,
mm-hmm.
with their own family.
Yes.
But they won't have to worry about that very long, because eventually we're not going to have families, and that's the goal, because eventually, there's only going to be enough people on the planet to just kind of flip levers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one example, John. Let's talk about this for a moment, if we could. One example of progress as a empty, vacuous concept is this idea that so-called reproductive rights are progress within the context of women's rights, abortion, and birth control. Those things aren't even really about women's rights, are they?
They never were. Even in the beginning, the two were never even connected. The women's rights movement basically had to do... it's interesting, even if you go back to the original women's rights movement, it was based around eugenics.
That's right.
Okay, and so eugenics, for people who don't know what that is, it's that you're going to breed the right kind of people,
mm-hmm.
and those are the people who are basically going to rule the world
mm-hmm.
at some point.
Right.
if there's enough breeding of the right kind of people. And so you could go into the writings of Margaret Sanger, who was a racist and a eugenicist.
Yes.
And you can read her books, and where she's talking about the evil blacks. She even had a project called the Negro Project, where she was going into black, you know, she proposed putting Planned Parenthoods in the black ghettos for the sole purpose of getting rid of the black population, because she thought it was a scourge on society.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, because a large percentage of black babies are aborted every year.
Yes.
And have been for a very long time. And so, and that's not to say that the white population hasn't been had detrimental effects from Planned Parenthood as well. But you see, you equate that with women's rights. So it's the woman's right
yes.
to abort her baby. But we're not aware of the real background purpose of it was for population control.
That's right. Yeah. And folks will know this name, obviously, but one of Margaret Sanger's biggest advocates and I think it's fair to say a disciple in the context that he took her philosophy and worldview concerning eugenics and applied it to an entire nation, and then his worldview, and his worldview included the conquest and the establishing of a master race, that'd be Adolf Hitler.
And Sanger even wrote letters to Hitler saying that he thought he was a good guy and he was doing a good thing. So
yeah.
So yes, that's an old thing. I mean, eugenics comes from the Greek. It comes you meaning good, genic meaning gene, the good genes.
Mm-hmm.
Plato talks about eugenics in the Republic. It's an old idea, and lots of people have tried over centuries to implement it and in different areas of culture, and unfortunately it's working.
Yes, that's right. Why is it that so many people are oblivious to this, John, the real roots and history of birth control, the purpose, the design behind it, abortion? I mean, I understand that these things have been repackaged and presented, as a nice looking bow wrapped gift, and every progressive woman who's interested in asserting her rights should be in favor of these things. But why is it that the nation as a whole has bought into this line that clearly is a lie?
Well, like I said, when you design a culture, there's certain things people are taught, there's certain things people aren't taught, and the histories of things get buried in the dust that's left behind of the previous generation. And there was at one time, people did kind of get wise to eugenics for a little bit and kind of not want to be involved with it, but it was quickly repackaged and renamed. And if you go into the writings of Julian Huxley, who was the brother of Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, which some people tend to think that Brave New World was some sort of, prophecy again, but it actually was a blueprint.
Yes, right.
And his brother Julian started UNESCO, which we just read from a book from UNESCO, and he actually coined the term transhumanism.
Yes.
And so he coined that term, and today we hear transhumanism lauded all over. Everyone from scientists to the Mormons love transhumanism.
That's right, yes.
And
the Mormons actually have a transhumanist association, an officially church-recognized group.
That is correct. And transhumanism was coined by Julian Huxley, who himself was an outspoken eugenicist before he actually wrote in papers, he said, we need to change the name of eugenics because it's got such a bad connotation associated with it. We just got to change it to transhumanism. So transhumanism is eugenics.
Mm.
And so people need to realize that when you hear the word transhumanism and that starts popping up everywhere, which it has, it is eugenics in disguise.
Yeah.
And
it's not a good thing. And just one more quick thing that I wanted to say here before I unfortunately have to go is, you see, you're fed all of this stuff through what's called mass media. If you've never heard of mass media, and the homogenizing effect that mass media has on everybody who's involved with it is largely, you're largely unaware of that effect.
Yes. Okay?
Limit and take time out of your life to limit your exposure to mass media, music, television, all those things that are running concurrently through the mass media and through your culture right now. So they're all giving you the downloads and the reinforcement to believe all of the things that you're seeing on the mass media. It's all reinforcement for you to believe all of those things as being real when they're not real, because they didn't exist until the mass media let you know that it was big system.
That's exactly right. Well, John, I appreciate your time today. I think we have enough to do a part two if you're willing to come back on the show at some point here in the next couple of weeks. I'd like to pursue that thought of the media and this groupthink among the media and where they get their marching orders from. And then I'd like to jump in and talk about the war on drugs, the irony of the war on drugs today, where that all came from. And so anyway, lots more topics to talk with John about. John, thank you so much for being on Soaring Eagle Radio. I appreciate it very much.
Mike, thank you very much. And I would love to come back on sometime and do another show with you.
Well, we'll chat and get that scheduled then.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Opening audio montage collection created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet, www.mika68.com, for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at woh.rr.com. God bless.